Versus Commonwealth. Mr. Ashahi, good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Jeffrey, good morning.
Good morning.
And you have 15 minutes. I will ask you in an abundance of caution if you'd like to reserve any time for rebuttal.
I do, Your Honor. Thank you. 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. May it please the court, I represent Mr. Williams. Several assignments of error. I'm going to address this court's jurisdictional issue.
And I suppose the $64 question in that is in light of the Daquan Terry case that just came out from the Supreme Court. Does that mean this should also be transferred?
Your Honor, we would answer that question no. And here's why. Unlike the Terry case, we're not alleging any kind of intrinsic fraud. That was the issue in that case, whether it was intrinsic fraud and the Supreme Court of Virginia.
Isn't your argument essentially to vacate a portion of the sentence?
It is, Your Honor. I mean, that's a good way of summarizing
it. And Terry says that a motion to vacate a conviction is not part of the criminal process and therefore is civil in nature.
Well, Your Honor,
what's different?
So I want to just make the observation that Terry is actually an unpublished opinion, and that has to be contrasted.
It's a pretty good hint for us, though, don't you think?
It reaffirms what they said in Southerly, it seems to me.
It's
so we really mean what we said in Southerly. That's the way I interpret Terry. So.
Well, I think this case can be distinguished from both Southerly and Terry, even assuming that all those cases are consistent. As I stated already, we're not alleging intrinsic fraud. We're not alleging, most importantly.
Well, let me follow up on Judge Russell's question, because it seems to me it isn't the underlying issue that's at stake. It's what you're asking. It's what the nature of the motion is. It's what you're asking the court to do. And, you know, basically, it seems to me in both Southerly and Daquan Terry, the Supreme Court has simply said that once the court has, you know, acted, appeals are exhausted, and you're seeking a remedy of vacation of an order for any reason, whether it's based on a fraud or any other reason, it's a civil motion, not a criminal motion. And because our jurisdiction is so limited by statute, the only other court available to take that motion to is the Supreme Court. That's sort of the way I read both Southerly and Terry. Tell me why that's wrong.
Yeah, I think Southerly Terry should be read with the Williams case. And I would just add to what you just said. Southerly and Terry, essentially, mainly Southerly, say that if you're challenging the jurisdiction of the circuit court, then becomes a civil matter. But if you're just filing just a regular motion to vacate, that's criminal in nature.
But what if the court doesn't have jurisdiction?
Well, Your Honor, I think I would...
Who says if the court has jurisdiction in a situation like that?
If the court is talking about the circuit court's jurisdiction, I would respectfully submit that issue is actually not before this court. The issue is the Court of Appeals jurisdiction. And I think if you look at the Williams case, in that case...
But our jurisdiction is derivative of the circuit court's jurisdiction based on the nature of what happened in circuit court. Isn't that true?
I think in a way that's true, but I think we've got to look at the Williams case. We can't ignore the Williams case, which came out shortly after the Southerly case. So, you know, obviously the court knew about the Southerly case. In Williams' case, the Supreme Court of Virginia, similar situation, a defendant filed a motion to vacate, and then the court said, and this court transferred to the Supreme Court of Virginia, saying, hey, this is civil, and the Supreme Court of Virginia said, no, it's not. We're going to send it back to the Court of Appeals. Now, there was a dissent in that case.
Well, I'm old enough to remember back when the Court of Appeals was first created, the issue came up about probation revocations, and the Court of Appeals ruled that probation revocations are really civil in nature because it's a preponderance of the evidence standard and so forth, which I think is correct. But that was before there was a transfer statute, and basically the court was dismissing appeals based on a lack of jurisdiction and told the lawyers were told to go file your appeal in the Supreme Court. Supreme Court basically said, no, Court of Appeals, you're technically correct. They are civil, but it's kind of close enough for government work for criminal cases, and you have jurisdiction, even though the statute would say otherwise. So I don't expect consistency from the Supreme Court of Virginia, because we certainly don't get it. But the point is, they said what they've said, and we have to, you know, follow their mandate to the best we can discern it. So,
but Your Honor, I forgot the name of the case that you just mentioned, but clearly the Supreme Court of Virginia sent it back to Court of Appeals saying, in the probation violation context, you have jurisdiction. And I think
Well, that bolsters. If we decided on this ground, you get heard eventually somewhere, right? Because either they send it back to us or they hear it.
Yeah, you don't have to refile. We just, the issue is whether we hear it or we transfer it.
Well, I mean, as a practical matter, we like to get two bites at the apple, Court of Appeals and Supreme Court of Virginia. So I think, but more importantly, we submit to you that this court has jurisdiction. And if you look at the Southerly case, and look at the subsequent cases, the operative language there is whether the appellant or the defendant in circuit court challenged the jurisdiction of the circuit court. That seems to be the distinction. And I think that's the way to reconcile Southerly, Williams, and Terry. If there's a challenge to the jurisdiction of circuit court.
But in both Southerly and Terry, they note that it's in the nature of a habeas. Well, habeas doesn't challenge the jurisdiction of the circuit court. In fact, it almost never touches on jurisdiction of the circuit court, because if there was a jurisdictional problem, you're not stuck with the habeas remedy.
Yeah, well, I didn't mean to suggest that that is the only way that this court will not have jurisdiction and the court and the Supreme Court of Virginia will have jurisdiction.
I don't think jurisdiction can be conveyed by just, you know, what you challenge or what you don't challenge. The issue is really whether we can act at all. You know, that's the first threshold we have to cross. And the problem, of course, is that we don't have plenary jurisdiction. We only have jurisdiction that the statute specifies. So the question is this appeal involve a final order of a criminal conviction? Arguably it does not, because, again, if it's deemed a motion to vacate, then it's civil in nature. If it's a direct appeal, it's, of course, criminal in nature. So, you know, we have to look at what you're appealing from and how you style your appeal, I think, to determine if we can even act on it in the first instance.
Well, yeah, I think I would respectfully disagree with, I think it does matter how the conviction is challenged. And I think that's important. And on the issue, so I think if we challenge the jurisdiction, that's one thing. If we don't challenge jurisdiction, that's another thing. And the way that the appellant...
Maybe I didn't make myself clear. I wasn't suggesting you were challenging the jurisdiction. We have to decide if we have jurisdiction.
Yes.
You know, because it doesn't matter what you're challenging. If we have no authority to act, you're in the wrong court, essentially. So we have to decide if we have jurisdiction. The Supreme Court has offered us... We can either describe it as a mandate or we can call it guidance, but we have to try to figure out what pigeonhole this goes in. If it's certainly if it's in the nature of a criminal appeal, we clearly have jurisdiction. But if it's anything other than that, it seems to me we don't have jurisdiction. Is there some hybrid that I'm not aware of where we have sort of maybe jurisdiction?
I think the hybrid is a good way of describing it. But Your Honor, if you look at the Southerly case, that case talks about how this court has jurisdiction over criminal convictions. And also, the language in Southerly suggests that, not suggests, but says it, that from actions and motions filed and disposed of while the circuit court retains jurisdiction. Now, I will just make the observation that...
Well, if that's the case, wouldn't we have to decide if circuit court had jurisdiction to determine if we had jurisdiction?
I think that's what one way of looking at it, but I just want to point out that, you know, actually 17.1-406, if you look at it, the statute that gives and takes away jurisdiction from this court, there's really nothing in there that says on motions filed and disposed of. It just talks about final convictions and other things that are not relevant to this case. But the reason I'm bringing that up is this. The motion that the appellant filed in this case back in, I think it's 2017, that was the kind of motion that Southerly talked about. When Southerly said this court has jurisdiction on criminal convictions and motions from action of motions filed and disposed of while the trial court retains jurisdiction. So I submit to you this.
What jurisdiction did the trial court have in 2017?
Well,
and that may get to the merits, but given the language you just quoted,
yes, Your Honor.
It seems to me we have to address that to determine whether it was a motion filed while the trial court returned jurisdiction. Jurisdiction, and as best I can tell, there's no even plausible argument that the court had jurisdiction from a final order from 10 years that was entered 10 years earlier. Yes. I've seen 22 days be argued, but yes. I haven't seen 10 years.
Well, Your Honor, we submit to you that there is an argument for why the circuit court had jurisdiction. Let me just start with the argument we haven't mentioned at all yet. We have challenged the proposition that the order from 2007 is a final order. And if you look at that order...
But setting aside Mr. Jeffrey's estoppel argument and setting aside it would be your burden to show us that the order book didn't have a signature at the end of the term or the end of the day, and Lynchburg apparently is the only place that does it that way. But setting both of those arguments aside, wouldn't that defeat any claim that we have jurisdiction if there's been no final order entered in the criminal case?
No, sir. With all due respect, no, because we're not appealing the 2007 order. We're appealing the 2017 order from the Lynchburg Circuit Court saying that court has no jurisdiction. That's the order that's before the court. That's the order that's being appealed. And I want to really go back to my argument that the 2007 order from Lynchburg doesn't have, it wasn't a final order. And we cannot be a stop from arguing something, because if the circuit court has jurisdiction, no matter what we do, what the AG's office does, circuit court has jurisdiction. And similarly, if they don't have jurisdiction, they don't have jurisdiction. So nothing that parties do is going to convey or take away jurisdiction. And I want to make sure we don't overlook the argument that order was not entered properly.
We don't know from this record whether it was entered properly or not.
Yeah, I don't know how we can. Your Honor, the order is the order. That's the order.
So, right, but the statute provides that there are any number of ways a judge can sign an order. The logical way, of the way that it's done just about everywhere else, is to sign. Well, the way you sign the order is that you sign the order. But the statute provides two alternative ways.
And
you can sign at the end of the day, or you can sign at the end of the term.
There's no indication that was done. I disagree with the proposition. It's our burden to show that this is a...
If the record is silent, given the procedural posture of this case, to whom do we owe the factual inferences?
Yeah, no, the record is not silent. We have the 2017 order that's before this court. That was signed by a judge. The 2007 order wasn't signed, and there's nothing in there. I mean,
well, we don't know if it was signed by a judge. We know it wasn't signed on its face.
You have the burden of persuasion. Motion and your appeal. You had the burden of persuasion in the trial court to establish either the lack of finality in the first instance and in the circuit court's jurisdiction in the second instance, seems to me. If we presume anything, it seems to me we presume regularity, which is the court did what it was supposed to do.
This court, Supreme Court of Virginia, has repeatedly stated that we look at the four corners of the orders. We look at
when the order is offered to establish something.
Yes, sir.
The Commonwealth didn't offer the order to establish something. You're the party who had the burden to establish something, and you said they didn't do it this of the three ways they were allowed to do it. They didn't do it one of the three ways. That doesn't foreclose they did it one of the other two ways.
You know, that is in the context when the Commonwealth is trying to, for example, show a prior conviction or something like that. And as we discussed in our brief, I think the three main cases on that issue, but all dealing with the admission of prior conviction. First of all, we don't think that's the standard to use. That is not. But even assuming that we're going to use that law applied to this situation, as we have stated, this order is different, significantly different than the orders that were approved by the appellate courts of Virginia in those three cases. All those orders had indications that other ways of they were entered, and there's nothing here. It's just a simple order. So the Commonwealth is asking the defense to prove something, prove a negative in essence. So how do we prove that nothing was signed? If nothing was signed, nothing was signed.
Well, you bring in the order book pages, and so there's no signature.
The most recent case
dealing with the Lynchburg, and I can't remember the name of it, but I was on the panel, Lynchburg order book, and proving a prior conviction, the Commonwealth offered the page from the end of the day, the end of the term, and it was signed, or the end of the day, and it was signed.
Here's the problem I have, in addition to what Russell just raised, is that it seems to me you're in a catch-22 situation here, because if you're taking the position that the 2007 order was not final, but the 2017 order is appealable, the 2017 order is clearly not a final order of conviction. It's a final order saying, I don't have jurisdiction. The court doesn't have jurisdiction. So, and if it's not a final order, if there's no final order of conviction, as you assert, then clearly we don't have jurisdiction to do anything, because then it would be an interlocutory appeal. So, I mean, it seems to me the remedy in the abstract is, if there's no final order, but the case is, you take the position the case has been fully disposed of, then the remedy would be a petition for writ of mandamus for the trial court to enter the appropriate order memorializing that which happened 10 years ago that you assert is not final. So, and then you'd have an appealable order. So, I mean, we're in this, I mean, what it seems to me any way you slice it, I just don't see, you know, how we get to act here.
That's why I cited the second part of the Southerly sentence on this court jurisdiction. That talks about final conviction and also motions acted upon by the circuit court when the circuit court has jurisdiction. The 2007 order was not final.
You have to take Southerly in the context of the statute. The statute spells out our jurisdiction. The Supreme Court doesn't get to determine our jurisdiction. The General Assembly does.
Yes.
And the jurisdiction in criminal cases is very clear, it seems to be in the statute. It's got to be from a final order of conviction in a criminal case. Now, if that order, that the 2017 order, I mean, I don't see anywhere on there where it says it's a final order of conviction. What it is basically denying a motion to do something for lack of jurisdiction. And so, you know, either that's correct, in which case we don't have jurisdiction, arguably, under Southerly and Terry, or it's incorrect, and your position is correct, which is there was never a final order in the first place, but you're exercising the wrong remedy here.
I think my time is up. I would just say quickly, the Southerly case is interpreting a statute, so I think that interpretation, whether it's inconsistent with the wording or not, it's binding. I'd like to reserve my time for a vote.
I hope
you have reserved a minute of overdue time.
You owe us a minute and 13 seconds.
I suspect Mr. Jeffrey won't use all of his time either. So,
good morning. May it please the court, Donald Jeffrey on behalf of the Commonwealth. The court's comments really sort of reflect our approach to this case, that 17-1406 is what governs and how you interpret that. And that was at the crux of what the Supreme Court talked about in Southerly. And it talks about you retaining jurisdiction on appeals for final criminal convictions and on motions filed and disposed of while the trial court retains jurisdiction over the case. Now, as Judge Humphreys implied a minute ago, we do have Williams out there that would seem to be a bit anomalous, but I have taken the position on brief that is a very narrow holding and is certainly distinguishable in this case. Our position is that the case ought to be transferred under Southerly. And the fallback position is, if you don't accept that this court's holding in Minor actually governs the issue of whether this is dismissed or affirmed. I know that the court asked for supplemental briefing in that case. I've actually read the supplemental briefs in that case, and I would suggest to you that, first of all, certainly the court's interpretation of 17-1406 to say that you didn't have jurisdiction in a case like this is binding on you. As far as the remedy, I think it's kind of implied that's how you decided to deal with it.
But given who wrote that, should we really pay it any attention at all?
Thankfully, I reread the opinion, so I won't stick my foot in my mouth on that. But I do think that even if you don't believe that it's binding on you, and I think there's a good argument that the way you queued up the supplemental briefing in the case that it is, I think the reasoning is persuasive in that case. You knew that was coming next.
I've never known you to be obsequious, so no, that was a surprise.
And I will say this, when I briefed this, I did go through this ritual of doing more federal habeas corpus procedural analysis than anyone here would probably want to hear, to think, if from our perspective, is there something that would militate against pushing one way or the other in the case? And I have to be perfect, because I think, to me, that's the only thing that will really affect this. I don't dispute that whether you dismiss it, the case, or you affirm the judgment below, that I believe the Supreme Court of Virginia still gets to review that. Your ruling on 1-1 and your ruling on 17.1406, I believe, is likely appealable and reviewable in the Supreme Court of Virginia.
Do you agree that Terry is, unpublished though it may be, is at least a strong hint what we should do?
I think it is. It's the issue you had in Terry, and I realize you were on the Court of Appeals panel in that case as well, and I think it is a very strong hint, and I will tell you that when we argued that case in the Supreme Court of Virginia, and you don't see this in the opinion, but we certainly suggested that Williams was a very narrow holding based on 19.2-296. You don't have a similar statute here, and I did. The only one I could point to was 303, and I've done an analysis on brief as to why I think that that doesn't work to implicate Williams. I suspect, although I don't know that you said it in the opinion, I suspect that one of the reasons you didn't transfer Minor is because that also dealt with a motion to withdraw a guilty plea. I don't recall that, because I was sort of trying to conjure up what I was going to tell you if someone asked me that question, and then it dawned on me that that actually is a case that probably is on all fours with Williams, which would be why you dismiss the appeal as opposed to transferring it. I don't think you have that here for the reasons I said on brief. And I think that we may get some further guidance down the road. But, yes, I mean, for those on the panel who don't know, Daquan Terry was a case that there was an accusation that a police detective was perjuring testimony to get search warrants, and it was filed about 5 years after the fact. It was actually a joint motion initially filed by the Commonwealth. The defense obviously joined that motion. The circuit court heard evidence and was denied, and the issue was, does the case get transferred under Terry or not? And this court held that it was, and the issue was actually before the Supreme Court of Virginia in that case. I was... the court's obviously familiar with the estoppel argument based on some of the questions, and Judge Humphreys pointed out what I said. If you don't have a final order, there's not appellate jurisdiction for other reasons. I would suggest to you, for all the reasons that everyone said about the adequacy of the record, though, that the defendant has not met his burden on that. Pretty much everything else on the merits, I've said everything I want to say on brief. I'm happy to try to answer any other questions that the court has. Judge Humphreys had to listen to me talk for 15 minutes yesterday, so trying to give him a break today.
I've been following you around the state. I just love listening to your voice, I guess. So.
Unless the court has further questions, I simply ask that you transfer this case, and in the alternative, dismiss the case under this court's holding in Minor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jeffrey.
Just very quickly, obviously, talking about Minor, we refer the court to the Lockyer case from 2005. On the issue of the final sentencing order, if we're to follow what the AG says, then that if this court doesn't have jurisdiction because the order from 2007 is not final, then we send the case back to Lynchburg Circuit Court, have the judge address the issues raised by my client on that motion. If that's the position, then I think that's the remedy.
Setting aside the estoppel,
yes.
I'm curious. There are any number of cases that say once the appellate court asserts jurisdiction over something, that the trial court loses jurisdiction. And so you had in 2008, I guess, this court assert jurisdiction over the case. Then you had the Supreme Court assert jurisdiction over the case when it denied the petition for appeal and issued its mandate of final judgment. How does a circuit court reobtain jurisdiction over a case if the Supreme Court has dismissed it and said final judgment under the mandate doctrine?
Your Honor, I think that doctrine is preempted by the whole case law on subject matter jurisdiction. The court either has jurisdiction or it doesn't. It doesn't matter what happens subsequent. It doesn't matter what position the parties take.
With all respect, Mr. Fairchild, I don't think it's a matter of subject matter jurisdiction. Clearly, the circuit court has subject. It's the whether it can exercise subject
matter
jurisdiction.
You're right. That's a separate jurisdictional issue, but my point remains the same. It's jurisdiction is there or it's not. I mean that's all there is. It doesn't matter what happens subsequently. If somehow we realize, oh wait a minute, there's no jurisdiction.
Well, the 21-day rule generally stands for the proposition that a circuit court cannot, or any court of record cannot, further exercise any jurisdiction. Even if it has subject matter jurisdiction, it can't actually use it after 21 days, subject to any statutory exceptions. Isn't that basically the bottom line?
That is, but there are some exceptions to that. For example, I think...
The exceptions are, though, specifically by statute.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think, and I'm sorry, I forgot the case, but there was one of those cases...
I forget the statute off the top of my head, but if you're still in the local jail, mm-hmm. even after 21 days, the court can modify the sentence.
Obviously that one, but there was another case that stated that... the 21-day rule doesn't prevent a circuit court from vacating an invalid orders, worse than effect. So I think that's another.
Clerical errors, that sort of thing.
Yeah, stuff like that.
801-428B, which was at issue in Minor.
Yes, sir. So I want to just wrap up with this. We talked about the orders not signed. You know, I think the statute, the reason we have that statute about why the order should be signed or other methods is we want to make sure that judges review these orders. We don't want just some clerk typing up the order and boom, it goes into the books. This court, I would say at least once a month, sends back a case to the circuit court, regardless of the merits of the case, saying, hey, there's an error in the sentencing order. Now, those are orders that the judge has read and signed, I'm assuming. And now, can you imagine the number of orders that are out there that are not valid or there's something wrong with them because the judge has not read them? I think...
Well, that's a great policy argument. As Judge Russell pointed out early on, the General Assembly has provided several ways that an order can become final, essentially.
And I wasn't... it's a policy argument, but it's based on the language of the statute. The purpose of that statute, I'm thinking, is we want the judges to read the orders. So there are different ways of making sure the orders are accurate, and that's one way. So it's a public policy argument, but it's based on what the statute says. And that has to be the reason for the statute. We don't want just orders being typed up by clerks and being put in a court spot. So for those reasons, we're asking the court to rule that this court has jurisdiction.
Thank you very much. We will come down and greet counsel then.